Commerce Committee to order. Today we have a number of public hearings and possible work sessions, and we're going to kind of go through the list as it's been provided to me. And so it looks like the first one we're going to open up is a public hearing on House Bill 2756. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2756A expands the definition of attending physician and workers' compensation claims to include chiropractic physicians, podiatric physicians, naturopathic physicians, and physicians' assistants, and authorizes compensable care for 60 days from initial visit for a total of 18 visits, allows providers to authorize temporary disability for 30 days, requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to provide informational materials, and requires medical service providers to review the materials, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. John Schultz, and also Phil Donovan and Michael Mason.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, they're coming forward. Is that a clarification?
Yes.
Ms. Braun, you said dealing with the 18 visits or 60 days, that's just for the chiropractors.
That's correct.
Right?
It's for the chiropractic physicians, podiatric physicians, naturopathic physicians, and physician assistants. 60 days from initial visit or 18 visit buildup.
For all of them or just?
For all of them.
Oh, okay.
Okay. John, why don't you start off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2756. This bill comes about as a result of a bill last session that passed both houses of the legislature, yet was vetoed by the governor. And as a result of that, the governor asked DCBS and the Management Labor Advisory Committee to review the role of chiropractors in the workers' compensation system, as well as other types of providers, if appropriate. And the governor at that time emphasized that the focus of that study needed to really be on the needs of workers and employers. So in 2006, the department conducted a study of care providers in the workers' compensation system, and there was a lot of information in that study about care providers and as well as surveys of injured workers and employers, literature review. There was a lot of analysis of data. Without going into all of the information, there were four care provider groups that really were the focus of the study, and those were chiropractic physicians, podiatrists, naturopaths, and physician's assistants. Now, since 1990, the workers' compensation system has limited the kinds of providers that can act as attending physicians or as a gatekeeper physician in the system. And it's the attending physician and the definition of an attending physician in the workers' compensation system that if you fit that definition as a care provider, you have quite a bit of authority. You're allowed to provide time loss or wage replacement benefits for injured workers. You can determine a worker's permanent partial disability. You manage the worker's return to work back onto the job. In 1990, it was the decision of then the Mahoney, what was known as the Mahoney-Hall Group, and the special legislative session that only medical doctors, doctors of osteopathy, and maxillofacial surgeons that were given full attending physician status. Chiropractic physicians were allowed a limited attending physician status for 30 days or 12 visits at that point, and other care providers were allowed 30 days or 12 visits from the date of the injury, but they were not allowed the ability to approve time loss or determine impairment or manage return to work. Based on the results of the study that was done here this last year, the Management Labor Advisory Committee is recommending the following changes: to allow chiropractic physicians, podiatrists, naturopaths, and physician assistants to act as attending physicians for 60 days or 18 visits. So it would be all four of the types of physicians, whichever comes first. And the clock on that 60-day point would start ticking whenever the first visit by one of those providers occurs. So it doesn't have to be the very first visit in the claim. So, for example, a worker who goes to an emergency room and sees a medical doctor and then decides they want to be treated by, let's say, a naturopathic physician or a chiropractic physician, that 60-day clock or 18 visit doesn't start ticking until that date of their first visit to that provider. The bill would also allow the four provider groups to authorize up to 30 days of temporary disability time loss benefit. They can manage the workers' return to work during that time period. It does continue the limitation on determining a worker's permanent impairment, permanent partial disability, to medical doctors, doctors of osteopathy, and maxillofacial surgeons. And finally, the bill requires that the department develop educational materials about the workers' compensation system, and it requires the four provider types certify that they've read these materials in order to act as attending physicians for that period of time. Now, in addition to these changes for the providers, the Management Labor Advisory Committee also asked the department to continue to closely monitor treatment patterns, cost impact, and other factors that can be affected by this bill's implementation, and to regularly report out those findings. And that's to determine if there's any sort of change that occurs that's unexpected. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
All right. Before we take questions, Phil, go next, then Michael.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2756. As John was talking, the interim care provider study demonstrated that injured workers seek out the care of naturopathic physicians. And the growth in the naturopathic profession, along with the growing public acceptance of naturopathic medicine, means that more people are beginning to seek out this kind of care. And we support changes to the workers' compensation system to ensure that injured workers with an established relationship with their naturopathic physician are able to see the person that they know and trust. And that is why we are in support of this legislation. And in reference to the time loss that's been expanded, you know, this is something that we had sought out, but we're very supportive of the short window, the net 30 days, because we think that taking people off the job is a big deal. And quite frankly, you can always go back and get a referral back to you if the time period were to elapse. So anyways, with that, we hope that you view House Bill 2756 as a positive change to the workers' compensation system. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Michael Mace. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. We support House Bill 2756A. We wanted to laud the thoughtfulness of the Department of Consumer and Business Services leadership and staff in working with chiropractic physicians and other physicians that are affected by this bill. We think it's a very important step forward to get to the 60 days and 18 visits. We think it will demonstrate that increased freedom for injured workers in the selection of their care providers does reduce costs to the entire system. So we appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and urge you to move this forward and start demonstrating that it will actually help the system and the workers as well. I wanted to just add that the director of the Chiropractic Association of Oregon has also asked me to put in a favorable word on the bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 2756? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2756. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2756. And,
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Move House Bill 2756 as no amendment, so as to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 2756A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll post the work session on House Bill 2756. And we'll open a work session, excuse me, a House, how about a public hearing at House Bill 2218. Any carriers on that one?
Any carrier?
Your choice, if you like it.
I can do it.
Yeah, Senator Monroe will be our carrier on 2756.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2218A makes changes to the workers' compensation statutes regarding temporary rules, change in attending physician, lump sum payments, and managed care organization penalties. It's my understanding that this is kind of a cleanup measure, housekeeping.
Okay. John, you're the only one that's listed here, so come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 2218A. This is we traditionally have a regulatory streamlining bill, and we introduced this bill in conjunction with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. The bill eliminates three functions by the Workers' Compensation Division, and it also enables the director to, we think, more effectively address managed care organization performance issues, and it makes the following changes. First of all, in regard to lump sum payments of permanent partial disability awards, today injured workers receive permanent partial disability awards if they have a permanent disability as a result of their on-the-job injury or occupational disease. And those awards, if they're under $6,000, they can get that award in a lump sum. If they're over $6,000, they have to request getting that award in a lump sum. Otherwise, it's paid out in a monthly benefit amount. They request the award from the insurer. If the insurer denies the lump sum payment request, the law automatically refers the issue to the department, to the director, to review the denied lump sum payment, whether or not the parties really want further appeal of the matter. If the insurer denied the lump sum payment for any of four reasons allowed by the statute, the director then just upholds the denial. If not, then we provide for the lump sum payment. HB 2218 consolidates into one section of the law when an insurer can deny the lump sum award and removes the director from the process of automatically reviewing all denied lump sum payments. If the worker disagrees with the insurer's decision, then they can contest that and request that the department be involved, just like we would in any other disability payment benefit in regard to seeing if there is an unreasonable delay or denial of the payment already provided for in ORS 656-26211. The second thing this bill does is in regard to change of attending physician. Workers are allowed or are entitled to three choices of attending physicians during the life of their workers' compensation claim. Once their original choices are exhausted, the director must provide or authorize additional changes. And some reasons that could happen is that the worker may be going to a doctor who retires, for example, or chooses no longer to treat the worker, so the worker needs to seek out a new treating physician. Current law requires that the director seek, if requested, the advice of one or more physicians when approving an additional change for that attending physician. Decisions by the director on this issue, we think, don't necessitate further consultation with physicians. And frankly, the division hasn't received any such requests in recent memory. HB 2218 eliminates the requirement for the director to consult physicians if requested when determining whether to approve an additional change in attending physician. Another piece of this bill is in regard to temporary rules for permanent disability awards. If a worker has a permanent disability that is not contemplated in the administrative rules or standards for addressing disability ratings, then we promulgate a temporary rule to provide for a disability benefit. The temporary rule applies only to that specific claim. It expires in 180 days, and it sets no precedence whatsoever for future claims. HB 2218 eliminates the requirement to adopt a temporary rule and instead allows the director to just determine the extent of a worker's disability in an order upon reconsideration, which then can be appealed to the hearings division of the Workers' Compensation Board if anyone disagrees with the decision. The fourth thing that this bill does, and as Ms. Braun, the committee administrator, pointed out, it's a little bit different. It's in regard to managed care organization penalties. Currently, in workers' compensation, you have managed care organizations, which are groups of providers and facilities that are certified by the Workers' Compensation Division to provide medical services to injured workers. The statutes in regard to managed care organizations provide that the department can revoke the certification of a managed care organization if we find that they have violated administrative law or have violated a statute. The problem with that is it's a little bit like the only option you have is to nail the managed care organization to the point that they very possibly could be put out of business. This bill gives the director the authority to address performance problems or violations of statute or rule by issuing civil penalties as well against a managed care organization that fails to comply with the law or administrative rules. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill, approved it, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I can.
All right. Any questions? I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 2218? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2218. Open a work session on 2218.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2218 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2218 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do we have a volunteer who wants to carry 2218?
Give it to Brad. It sounds like a lawyer bill.
All right. Abakim gets this one for his attendance today. All right. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2218, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2247.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2247A repeals the sunset on the law allowing nurse practitioners to provide compensable medical services and workers' compensation claims. This one needs a conflict amendment, so it should not be worked today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is Brian, he had another meeting. He told me he may not be here. John, why don't you come on up? And I know that Brian is in support of this, but I know that he had another commitment at 3.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here in support as well of House Bill 2247A. In 2003, House Bill 3669 was passed through both houses of the legislature, and it essentially expanded the role of nurse practitioners in the workers' compensation system to allow them to provide medical services for up to 90 days and authorize time loss for up to 60 days and manage the workers' return to work during that period of time. Workers were also provided with the ability to bring along their nurse practitioner into a managed care organization under specific circumstances. And like was stated in the earlier bill, nurse practitioners were required to certify with the Workers' Compensation Division that they'd reviewed educational materials developed by the division in order to provide compensable services. As part of that bill, there was a sunset put on this provision, that is for January 1st, 2008, in case that this change did not work well. The department, as part of the bill, was asked to perform a study to determine whether or not there was a negative impact as a result of allowing additional authority to nurse practitioners to treat injured workers. We did perform a study, and the biggest challenge in that study was finding data at all, frankly, because what we found is that there's very, very minimal system impact of allowing nurse practitioners the expanded status. Based on the analysis of medical billing data reported to the department, nurse practitioner billings remained the same before and after the law change, and they amounted to 0.06% of the total medical billings in the system. In addition, analysis of data provided by Safe Corporation showed that the payments to nurse practitioners acting as attending physicians was also very small, less than 1%, 0.2% of the total payments made by Safe on claims were for nurse practitioner billings. We did find from some nurse practitioners who answered survey questions that they felt that that they were in a better position of being able to continue to treat their patients who also suffered injuries on the job. Based on these findings and the survey conducted of the nurse practitioners, the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee recommended removing the sunset and making the nurse practitioner law changes permanent. And I'm here to ask for your support and would be happy to answer any questions I can on this bill.
All right, questions, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, John, is it fair to say that nurse practitioners often give better service in these situations and always charge less?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I don't know about the quality of the service. The costs were certainly lower with what we found in terms of nurse practitioners. I think what we found was there are workers who want to treat with their nurse practitioner, and we didn't find any reasons why they shouldn't.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes.
And isn't it true that especially in rural areas, sometimes nurse practitioners are the only caregivers that are readily available?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, that's true.
Thank you. Good bill.
Senator Beyer?
Thank you. I guess I'm just curious to know what bill we're conflicting with, and can you give us information on the amendment needed?
The conflict is with two other bills we're hearing today, actually, 2756 and 2244. And the conflict was with both those bills had a conflict with House Bill 2247A. And so the thought was that Legislative Council could amend 2247A and remove the conflict.
Excuse me, what was the last part of what you said?
I'm sorry. The conflict was with 2247A, so Legislative Council suggested we could just amend that bill and remove the conflict with the other two bills.
All right. Any other questions? John, I think that's it for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2247? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2247. We're now going to open a public hearing on 2244. Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2244A eliminates the sunset for permanent partial disability awards in workers' compensation claims. It requires the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee to review permanent partial disability benefits and make recommendations on a biennial basis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your patience and attention with me today. Again, for the record, my name is John Schiltz, and I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 2244A. I've spoken a little bit about permanent partial disability awards today. Permanent partial disability benefits are a significant benefit in workers' compensation. When injured workers suffer permanent a permanent impairment or disabling condition as a result of their on-the-job injury or occupational disease, they receive compensation for that, and it's in addition to the money they may receive to replace their wage loss while they're not medically stationary. It's in addition to medical benefits. It's actual compensation for impairment and loss of earning capacity. In 2003, the legislature passed Senate Bill 757, which fundamentally changed the way we calculated permanent partial disability benefits. And basically what that bill did is it changed the benefit structure so that all workers continued to be eligible for an impairment benefit. The amount that their range of motion, their basic physical impairment that they had as a result of their injury. But it also said that workers that were unable to return to their regular work were given work disability benefits tied to the worker's wage and injury. Prior to this, we had a rather more complex schedule of benefits, some benefits being scheduled, some referred to as unscheduled, and depending on where you fell, and it was about four different statuses in the old benefit system, it determined the amount of award that you received. This actually, in my opinion, simplified the benefit structure somewhat, but it also tied people's loss of earning capacity to their wages. What that did was it made changes to people's loss of earning capacity matched much more to the wage they were earning at the time of injury. As part of the discussion on that bill, SB 757, a sunset was placed on that bill for January 1st, 2008. Then in 2005, a second bill was passed, HB 2408, which made additional changes, and it was specific to the eligibility for the work disability benefit. It excluded workers who were released by their physician to return to their regular job from eligibility for work disability benefits. That bill, there was also a sunset placed on that change for January 1st, 2008. As required by the 2005 legislation, DCBS studied the impact of the permanent partial disability statutory changes made by these two bills. The study that was done showed that the law changes did redistribute the permanent partial disability benefits from workers who were able to return to work more towards workers who were unable to return to their regular work. Workers with longer term injuries and more work disability were receiving the higher awards. This was consistent with the policy goals intended by MLAC and the legislature when the statutory changes were made in 2003 and 2005. The DCBS study also showed that the law changes were cost neutral within the overall system. In other words, the overall amount of permanent partial disability benefit that is spent by the system had not changed. What did change was individual beneficiaries found changes in what they would have gotten depending on whether you used the old system or the new system. And we knew that individual workers' permanent disability awards would change, as well as potentially individual employers and individual insurers would see some changes depending on the types of injuries that they had and the types of wages that they paid. Overall, however, the study data did not demonstrate a significant difference in overall cost impact of the system. Based on the results of the study, MLAC recommended making the 2003 and 2005 permanent partial disability law changes permanent. In addition to removing the sunsets, the bill requires that MLAC biennially study and make recommendations about permanent partial disability benefits to ensure that policy goals continue to be met over time. And this is an important point that I don't want to pass over too quickly because as I've already just discussed with one member of the committee, sunsets have been long used in permanent partial disability law in workers' compensation. What this part of the bill will do will require that the Management Labor Advisory Committee biennially review and make recommendations about permanent partial disability benefits in order to ensure that there's regular review and discussion of those benefits. This section was added because the issue of the sunsets was brought up to MLAC. First, in regard to the sunsets adding complexity to the statute and adding complexity to bills that have to be written. And second, that the sunsets do force parties to return to issues and reexamine them. MLAC decided to address both of those concerns by adding the responsibility for MLAC to biennially review this part of the statute. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can about this bill.
All right, any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to thank John. It was my request that he provided me with the history of sunsets on this issue. And prior to 01, also, the sunsets were on exclusive remedy in workers' comp to keep both sides at the table. And so I appreciate you giving me that list at a short notice.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, any other questions for John on this?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Cordley.
A quick question. Could you provide, please, an example to me of what is meant by the phrase social, vocational factors of age, education, and adaptability taken together? What would we be looking at, just by example?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Cordley. In determining the full disability benefit, we look at the impairment amount, the loss of use, let's say, of range of motion of just an arm, perhaps, if it's the injured body part. Then we also look at the age, educational level, and adaptability. So what that would mean is if somebody is over 40 years of age, for example, they're considered to have actually more disability than someone who is younger. If they do not have a high school diploma, for example, they have more disability than someone who does. On adaptability, if the physician has said that they're now precluded from moderate or moderately heavy or heavy occupations, they're considered to be more disabled than a physician that has precluded someone just from, let's say, heavy occupations. So all of those factors are then looked at in terms of the standards administrative rules that we pass in regard to calculating permanent partial disability. And there's an actual mathematical calculation that goes into determining the percentage of whole body that is disabled, and that equals a certain amount of money under the system.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? So, John, the bottom line on this bill here is basically going to take off those two sunset clauses in those two different areas, and we'll continue to operate as it has been with the sunset on it.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Well, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2244, House Bill 2244? We'll close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2244. Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2244 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2244 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, discussion, any objection? So ordered. And Senator Gordley, will you take this one?
Certainly.
You're carrying the last one, by the way. Hmm? You got to carry the last one, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. 237.
Yeah, and Senator Avakian, thank you for being the carrier on the previous bill.
Anything I can do to help?
Thank you very much.
In my absence?
We call this a work session.
Good thing I showed up. I'd have had eight of them after that.
I was holding back for strength. 2244, we're opening up a public hearing on 2250.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2250 allows the Director of Consumer and Business Services to impose a surcharge on assigned risk pool participants. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let's see. Looks like John's back up on deck again.
Why did he go away?
All
you again, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2250A. This bill is a little bit different than the ones I've talked to you about before. Oregon law requires that Oregon employers with subject employees have workers' compensation insurance. It's a mandatory insurance program, in other words. And unfortunately, some employers are unable to obtain workers' compensation insurance in the regular insurance market. And so we have what's known as the assigned risk plan to provide coverage for those employers who are unable to obtain insurance through the what we call the voluntary market. What this bill does is it basically would ask the legislature to give the director authority to implement one of actually several things that we want to do as a result of the study of the assigned risk plan, which was conducted during this last interim. And I do believe there's a copy of the study's executive summary attached to my testimony. And getting some blank looks, perhaps not, so I can go over that with you. The department did study the assigned risk plan. We studied it in the before the 2005 session, and we've studied it again before this session to determine whether it's really serving the purposes for which it was established and whether any changes are needed. And what we found is that placement in the assigned risk plan occurs for very predictable reasons, such as being a new business or having a very, very small premium base, having being in a certain nature of a business. Helicopter logging comes to mind, for example. Having poor loss experience, having a poor payment history, for example. All those things can land one in the assigned risk pool. More than half the employers in the assigned risk plan had been in the plan for 12 months or more, but about 73% of the plan is made up of employers with very small premium. Now, that's an important point because the assigned risk pool acts as an incubator for new and small business in Oregon. It's a place where new and small business can obtain that mandatory coverage that they can't always get in the voluntary market. On the downside, the assigned risk plan doesn't always collect sufficient premium to pay for its losses. What we've been seeing over the last couple of years are deficits in the assigned risk plan. And when there is a deficit, the voluntary market basically subsidizes those deficits. In other words, how it works in Oregon is if there's a deficit in the assigned risk plan, we assess the insurers to make up the deficit, and they pass that through to their customers. So the voluntary employers are paying for the losses of the employers in the assigned risk plan. Now based on the study and looking nationally, it really does appear actually that the Oregon assigned risk plan is working pretty well. But there's always room for improvement, and we've made several recommendations to fine-tune plan operations to help employers obtain voluntary market coverage where it's possible, to improve incentives and programs to keep employers from entering the plan in the first place. All of our recommendations can be implemented administratively except for this one. HB 250 is the only statutory change that we need. And under the law, all workers' compensation insurers, as I mentioned, are required to pay their proportionate share of the assigned risk plan that exceeds the premiums collected. The law currently prohibits us from charging any of the assigned risk plan losses directly to the assigned risk plan employers. That's called a surcharge under the law. HB 2250 deletes the prohibition on surcharging employers in the plan, but it does, but it doesn't require the surcharge be levied. It removes the prohibition of a surcharge So it gives the director the option. It gives the director another tool to put in her tool belt to charge assigned risk plan participants for losses if other pricing mechanisms don't address plan shortfalls. But again, it doesn't require the director to do that. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill and voted to support it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I could about this bill.
Questions on House Bill 2250. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. John, what other pricing mechanisms are anticipated? You just said it doesn't, that she can already do that, but not surcharges. So what else is there?
Basically, there are several that came out of the study. I'll just hit a couple. One of the things that we can do already is put loss-sensitive pricing into the plan. There are large, and in fact, we've already administratively done this. There's some large employers that are in the plan, and they can actually escape higher voluntary market pricing through a retroactive plan by staying in the assigned risk plan where there's a guaranteed cost to the plan. By putting in more loss-sensitive pricing for larger employers, we by administering what would actually be almost a retroactive plan for larger employers in the assigned risk plan, you can actually be more sensitive to larger employers in terms of asking them to pay premium that's more commensurate to the losses that they're generating. So what we did as a recommendation on the study was put a loss-sensitive plan into place for employers that have over $200,000 in assigned risk premium. In the case that they actually do well in terms of managing their losses, they would not experience any increase in cost with that. However, if they do not manage their losses well, they would see their premiums going up. So that's an example. And there's another example is what we're calling the Voluntary Coverage Assistance Program. It's a pilot program that we're trying for employers when they apply to the assigned risk pool, where we actually are trying to match certain types of employers with voluntary market insurers. The requirement today is that an employer be turned down one time, and then they can apply into the plan. What this would do is actually, for example, give us the ability. I mentioned helicopter logging before. If there is an insurer out there who has an underwriting program for an employer like that, we can then match them and keep them from entering the assigned risk plan, and they go into the voluntary market that way.
Follow up? Yes. John, under current law, if we did nothing, it says a surcharge does not include modifications pursuant to an experience rating plan. So in the assigned risk pool, the director can already do, and is that where you came with these loss-sensitive pricing and ideas of, because they can do modifications based on experience, right? Like the voluntary market does.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that if employers of sufficient size, they get an experience rating modification, and that experience rating modification is a multiplier against their premium. So it can either be less than average or more than average, or typically average. And after a time, yes, your experience does catch up with you in terms of pricing with that.
Okay, another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm just trying to make sure I'm reading this chart right, John. Thank you for providing it to me. The assigned risk plan as the losses in the last year of a little over $8 million, that would amount to almost a 14% surcharge on employers in the assigned risk pool, but only a 1.4% surcharges or whatever you want to call it, that the rest of the people in the voluntary plan pay to make up that difference. Is that number look right? Or is it, I don't know if you have a copy of it with you or not. But.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, no, that I think you're reading that correctly. There's a And the reason for that is the vast majority of employers are in the voluntary market. So there's a lot more premium there in the voluntary market than in the assigned risk plan.
And another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And if this surcharge was to go into place, I mean, the vast majority in number of the assigned risk plan is small or first-time insurers, brand-new businesses. And, you know, they already have a somewhat higher rate by being in the assigned risk plan than someone in the voluntary market. If you were going to hit them with a 14% surcharge in addition to that, that's going to put them in a real competitive disadvantage. So is there somehow, if the surcharge is going into place, would the director be able to only apply the surcharge to certain people in the assigned risk plan, or does it have to be across the board?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, right now there's just a prohibition to using it at all, and we're removing that, and your question, I think, is right on. It does not require the director to apply the surcharge across the board. It doesn't require the director to apply the surcharge at all unless they want to. So the director would have the ability to apply the surcharge selectively or in years not at all, in fact. In fact, we would expect it to be the last thing that we would want to do in most years. But I think the answer to your question is yes. It gives the director flexibility to apply the surcharge selectively or partially.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The other things that you said that could be tried or have been tried, the loss sensitivity pricing or the voluntary coverage assistance program, have those actually started, and if so, when?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, the loss sensitive program was just started with employers who were purchasing their insurance for the first time in January of 2007. So it's been in effect for approximately 5 months. And what we have seen has been, and this is more anecdotal than anything else, but we have seen some employers moving to the voluntary market, some of the larger employers moving to the voluntary market rather than going with the loss-sensitive plan inside the assigned risk pool, which was what we wanted, is to move them that way. The other plan I talked about, the voluntary coverage assistance plan, has just been started. It's in a pilot phase for employers. Some other states have tried it. Some have had some good luck with it. We've just started, and I don't have any data to report yet on it for you.
Any other questions on 2250? John, I think that's it for this one. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2250? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 2250, open a work session on House Bill 2250.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Bakken moves House Bill 2250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions? Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chair, I understand the desire of the director here. I think that it may be a little premature, and whereas this is just voluntary, I'm looking at this, the percentage increases. If this percentage was assigned across the board in the assigned risk pool to the assigned risk pools there for these vulnerable employers, and a 14% surcharge across the board, if it was done in that manner, is versus a less than 1.5% surcharge, that the rest of us paid to make up that difference. I support the concept of moving these, specifically these larger employers. I mean, we're talking employers of more than $200,000 in premium. I think all carriers consider those large employers in the voluntary market. I don't know what the cutoffs are for like Safe or Liberty, but I think it's about if you have more than $50,000 in premium, you are considered a large employer. So I think it's good that the department tries to get those employers out of the assigned risk plan. I'm afraid that I would like to see these other options go forward prior to a surcharge, And so I'm a little conflicted on this bill as to whether or not to support it, because it is a voluntary, I recognize that. But at the same time, it seems like it should have about a 1 year, 2 year starting deadline out there to let these other options work. And I realize that I probably have information here that the rest of you don't, but the loss and the sign of this plan.
I actually thought you were going to carry the bill since you had all that information in your phone.
It's quite variable. In 2001, it was $1.7 million. It went to $6.3 million in 2002, then back to $2.8 million in 2003. So it is very variable. It can really jump around, and the amount put on to everyone else's premiums is a very small amount to make up the difference. So, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate not carrying the bill, because I still don't know how I'm going to vote on the bill. And I just like put all that on the record, I guess, as I'm trying to stall for time to figure out how I'm going to vote.
Okay. Well, I mean, at this point, is there something that we think that we can do to make it better at this stage? I mean, to me, it seems like this is a likely next step, understanding there could be some other next steps before this step would be taken.
I agree with that statement. It seems like this bill is about 2 years too soon, I think, is what it is for me right now. It's just they've just done some other things to try to look at it, and two things that just started this year. And as I said, I recognize it is voluntary by the director, but sometimes that doesn't give employers a lot of solace either if they're...
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go ahead and I think I'd like to go ahead and go forward with this. And I think what we can do, Senator Beyer, is note this on the record, and I think on the floor as well, as to watching to see how it's actually used, knowing it is optional, not a mandatory requirement on the part of the director, that hopefully she will be using this in a judicious means and with the other tools that she has, just if necessary, understanding that there could be some fallout that we may not anticipate, that where it would be more appropriate to use it now as compared to waiting to see if the other things actually equalize stuff out. So did you want to be registered as a nay or nay at this point?
No, Mr. Chair, I'll support the bill, and I guess we'll just make sure it's that is put on the record that this is supposed to be, as testified by Mr. Schiltz, this is a last option director should use as a way to control the costs or to control the losses. Okay. In the signers pool.
All right, if there's not any other discussion, then it will be approved. And knowing that you get to put all this stuff on the record, would you mind carrying it and then making sure it's on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Beyer. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 2250. And we're going to open a public hearing on 2222. And I have two individuals who want to give testimony on this one, Michael Wood and Mary Botkin. Why don't y'all come on up? And Anna, why don't you give us the overview? And I haven't forgot 2221. We have just someone that needs to move to another committee, and we want to go ahead and get their testimony on now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2222 removes the requirement that employers with more than 10 employees have a safety committee, and instead requires all employers to have a safety committee or safety meetings, authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to make rules allowing alternative forms of safety committees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Michael?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA, and I am here today to provide information and request the committee's support for House Bill 2222. The safety committee requirement in the statute was actually one of the workers' compensation reforms passed in 1990 as part of the Mahonia-Hall package, and it, by and large, has worked well for workers in the state of Oregon and their employers in reducing workers' compensation losses. However, there are some difficulties in the law, and those are outlined in more detail in my written testimony. I will just touch on a couple of them briefly. The issue is particularly difficult for small employers. For large employers with more than 10 employees, they have to have a safety committee under the statute. Employers with 10 or fewer employees do not have to have a safety committee unless they cross one of two threshold triggers. One of those is if they, as an individual employer, have a lost workday case incidence rate in the top 10% of all rates for the employers in that industry. In other words, if they're in the worst 10% by their injury rate at a given time. Now, that, of course, is information that the typical employer doesn't know in terms of how they compare, and that can create a moving target, and a target that's moving without them even being aware of it. The second provision is that for employers other than agricultural employers, in industries that are in the riskiest 25% of all the industries in the state, they are required to have a safety committee without regard to size. Now, for very small employers, both those provisions can create some difficulty. An employer, a framing contractor, and framing or roofing, I will tell you, will always, you know, have historically always been in the top 25%, may have one or two employees. Under the existing law, they are required, and it's statutory, to have a safety committee. And they have to have that safety committee, and then they have to comply with the rules that we've adopted in implementing the statute. Any small employer, and it's particularly true in relatively low-risk industries, any small employer who has a disabling claim in a given year is going to pop past that top 10% threshold, so that single claim can create a problem. To give you an illustration of that, early in my tenure here, I received a call from an employer, and it actually was an agricultural employer. And she had received a letter that we sent out notifying her that the business had an injury and illness rate above the average for that industry. And she called and she said, well, you know, I really don't understand this. We've only had one injury in 25 years. How can this be? And I said, well, when did it occur? And she said, last year. And I said, well, we're looking at a 12-month period. I'm assuming that you're a fairly small business. And she said, well, yeah, we only have the one guy, and he's part-time. Now, I didn't get into the safety committee requirement with her, deciding that discretion was the better part of valor. I wasn't about to tell her that under the law she was required to bring that individual back on light duty so that he could be the employee representative on the safety committee. But strictly speaking, that is what the law would have required in that situation. It's issues around those smaller employers where I think we have problems with the requirements being inflexible and, frankly, in some places being less effective than a more general safety meeting model, and that's why we've introduced this proposal. Leaving the details to be worked out in the rulemaking means that we can provide maximum flexibility to the process and for employers while at the same time focusing on the effectiveness of the employee involvement measures that are being used in actually getting effective employee involvement and getting safer workplaces. In addition to issues around size, there are issues related to mobile workforces, and there are issues related to dispersed workforces, having, you know, very small crews or even individuals in a multiple of sites. A traditional committee structure isn't necessarily the best way to get those employees involved in dealing with their own safety and health issues. For these reasons, We have put this bill forward. We did, because it was one of the Mahoney Hall reforms, take it to the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee, and they agreed that it was time to apply our experience of the last 16 years and actually coming up with a more workable framework without compromising on the essential nature of employee involvement in providing workplace safety and health. I thank you for your time, and I would welcome any questions you may have.
All right. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We're here to support House Bill 2222. We do not believe it goes far enough. We do not believe it compels our employers to do anything that they're not doing now. And but Mike and I had this conversation. I have agreed not to try to fix the bill from our perspective, but rather to work with him during the rulemaking process. I do feel compelled to say that it has been my experience that some of our state employers are the worst offenders. They have safety committees that are charade committees. They want to talk, for example, in corrections, they want to talk about slip and fall. Our officers want to talk about stabbings. They want to talk about wet floors. Our officers want to talk about inmate incidences that injure inmates as well as officers and staff. there's nothing in this bill that will compel them to do anything real or anything different. What I am willing to do is to work with Michael during the interim to see if we can beef up some of the language through rule and at least make it clear that we're serious about this. There will be a bill in front of this committee soon, House Bill 3357, that will require the state of Oregon to actually put workers who've been injured on the job back to work. A novel concept that all private sector employers have to follow now. We've changed the law to read shall rather than may for state employment, and we're going to be a little more active in making sure that they return some of our injured workers back to the job. But at this point, we find the state of Oregon to be abysmal in their treatment of injured workers, and it's just unacceptable. We're going to go through another two-year period of trying to work with the state and try to work with the departments that are in charge of this. And if it doesn't work, we'll be back next session. But, you know, I just want the committee to know that all is not wonderful in Alice in Wonderland for everybody. And the safety committees were supposed to be there as a joint way of dealing with real safety problems on the job. And it's been our experience that that's not happening. So, you know, we just sort of want everybody to be on record.
All right. Thank you. Question, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, we had this discussion already. I've been sitting here. Thank you for providing with me the rules today on that. And this is more going to be a statement than a question, but committee, this, to me, this is really poorly drafted. I understand where they want to go. I support where they want to go. But what we're going to have here, is the way this is drafted, is we're going to have a statute, ORS 654-176, that says all employers shall establish safety committees. Then you're going to have to go to the next section, 654-182, which is a new statute, to find out the rules and the exceptions. And it seems to me that it's I understand where they want to go with this. I think it's a good idea to allow flexibility, but it's just going to be confusing, I think, to people and employers that, I don't know, one chapter, one statute, it says everyone has to have a safety committee, but then you have to go to the next chapter to find out everyone necessarily doesn't have to go and have a safety committee. It depends on what rules or OSHA wants to write about those safety committees and how they work. And I don't know if it would be helpful or more clear if legislative council would combine this into one statute so it was all in the same place, especially with the world of the internet. If someone wants to look up a statute, they might not look at a book that has them listed one after another, but just look up one statute and then not realize there's another one. I don't know. It seems like it's going to be confusing when you take all that language and have it in two separate chapters now.
Okay.
And the guy who drafts this here.
Charlie, you probably walked in the room at the wrong time. Would you be so kind to maybe come up to the dais here, to the table? Mr. Cheat, we have House Bill 2222 in front of us. And I understand you may have been the drafter of this bill.
Actually, I've taken over the area since Doug McKean went on to bowling, but
okay.
I would be responsible for the bill.
Right, there's a question. I think what I'm going to do is I'm not going to put you on the spot to actually answer it now without you having a chance to look at it. But if you look under on the bill as it's written under Section 1, is the changing of ORS 654.176, and it talks about saying that everyone will be required to have the safety committee, and then Section 2 gives kind of an exception to that under ORS 654.182, and apparently there's exemptions there. The question that Senator Beyer brought up is there some way that we could combine those together or maybe put something in the Section 1 language that refers people to the exceptions so they know to be looking beyond that one statute as to
Let me clarify, Mr. Chair. It already is in the first section. It does say pursuant to rules adopted under the second section. But my question would be more specifically, couldn't this all be one in the same statute so a person wouldn't have to go from one statute to another to find out what the exceptions to the first statute was, and why are we having rules promulgated under one statute instead of doing it all in a single statute?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Byers, again, Charlie Cheek from Council. I'd like to look at that before I respond to it. I think it might be possible, certainly at least possible, to provide perhaps a statutory reference to the subsequent statute. We often say as provided in ORS, in this case maybe 654-182, if that's the issue. But until I've had a chance to sit and analyze it a little bit, I don't want to say, sure, we can just put it in one statute and make it work that way.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Beyer, if I may, although I realize it wasn't entirely a question, and the drafting and why it's in two separate sections, I actually can't address the underlying statute. I have the same question about why it was two sections. There are a couple observations I might make that might be useful. The first is that the requirement in the first section is no longer, under the bill, a requirement to have a safety committee. It is a requirement to have safety committees or to have safety meetings, and that's a much lesser requirement. And in fact, when you look at the rules we have about training, communication-related hazardous chemicals, all ranges of things, it's difficult for an employer to envision complying with this existing rules without having meetings with their employee. The second thing I might mention is that experientially, I think the place that the people look for the requirements are actually in the Oregon OSHA rules, because that's where they're looking at the other rules that govern the workplace. So in terms of a communication tool for employers to know what's required, the statute really isn't the place that they typically turn to anyway, although obviously it's the ultimate authority in resolving a dispute over potentially the rules.
That's probably true. Senator Bakken.
With respect to the elimination of the 10-employee threshold, I don't understand why we're being asked to do that. If there have been situations that have occurred with small employers since the initial bill was passed that say that we need to have those small employers doing something?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Avakian, there, of course, never was an absolute 10-employee threshold. The original bill recognized that for higher-risk industries, it was prudent to have safety committees or some continuing form of employee involvement. And in most construction activities, that has typically occurred since this was passed. We do run into cases with construction employers and at times with small construction employers where there are breakdowns in the operation of their safety committees and in the effectiveness of their communication with their employees. The reason that the 10-employee threshold is being eliminated in the bill is that rather than focusing on a 10-employee threshold and then that disabling claims rate, which for small employers really is a meaningless indication of risk, it doesn't get to the highest indications of risk, rather than having that 10-employee threshold, this would use the combination of a safety committee requirement and a safety meeting requirement and direct us to adopt rules that take into account the needs of small employers. I would envision that those rules would include threshold, perhaps more than one threshold, not only based on size but also based on the relative risk of the industry. But what I would not expect those rules to include is the moving target of the disabling claims rate. They'd be based on better indicators of risk that were more stable and that employers could rely on in confidence, knowing that if they were in compliance with the rules this year and nothing changed, they would remain in compliance with the rules next year.
All right. Senator Cordley.
Thank you very much. I wanted to address comments to Ms. Botkin. Thank you for coming back. I take seriously, very seriously, your comments about the state of Oregon as an employer. Statements like abysmal treatment of workers, charade safety committees. I don't think we can just leave those comments hanging out there without addressing what you've said. And so I want to ask you, has there ever been a legislatively appointed task force, a joint task force, that looked critically at safety issues?
Not since the closure of Fairview. We had an extensive task force prior to the closure of Fairview because of the high injury rates at Fairview related to handling of clients and those issues. And about the same time, there was an inspection done in the Department of Corrections that resulted in, if I remember correctly, about a $450,000 fine levied against the Department of Corrections for safety violations. And the Ways and Means Committee, in its infinite wisdom, determined not to levy the fine, but rather to give the money back to the department in exchange for making safety changes within the institutions. That has been some almost 20 years ago. There has not been... I think, you know, one of the things that was the worst was in the last couple of years, the Department of Corrections, one of our institutions, got Safe Employer of the Year Award the same year that three officers were beaten severely in the rec yard by inmates during an incident. And those are, I mean, it's just sort of salt in the wound for our members who don't see that anybody takes their safety very seriously. And I don't have a complaint with OROSHA. I don't have a complaint with the Workers' Comp Department. My complaint and our members' complaint is with their employer. And again, I don't see anything in the bill that compels the state to come to the table. So the short answer is, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, no, there has not been for a long time a serious look at the state of Oregon as a safe employer generally.
Thank you for responding. And I want to say to you that it's the issues that you're raising are something that I'd like to work with you on in a way that has this institution, the legislature, paying a different kind of attention to the issues that you're raising, because I've heard you raise them before on the Ways and Means public safety side. I also want to appreciate that you're willing to work with Mr. Wood on establishing administrative rules for this measure, but again, appreciating that you're saying that this doesn't go far enough and that you're trying to get our attention here, and you've got mine. I want you to know that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. And if you're going to amend the bill, I'd be happy to work with Mr. Wood on some amendments. I have no interest in holding the bill up in committee, but if you're going to do amendments to the bill anyway, I'd like to offer some amendments that would compel our employers to sort of come to the table in a real way to solve safety problems and to do it in labor management cooperation. I mean, this is not an us and them. This ought to be us together. A safe working environment is good for everybody. So, you know, and I'm willing to spend some time doing that. But, again, you know, you don't have to hold up the bill for me.
Right. Okay, I think what we're going to do is we're going to let Mr. Cheek look at this one issue. Mary, if you have a few things that you want to put on the table, then I would say you need to coordinate with Anna. And we'll see whether or not that can be accommodated now or whether it needs to. I already heard you on the record saying that you're willing to work with them during the interim. And we may take that approach now instead of loading this with additional stuff. So let's just see what we have and see how we can put it in. And we may move the bill just as it is at this time without any changes.
That's fine.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you. And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate, on House Bill 2222? Not. We're going to close the public hearing on 2222. We'll open a public hearing on 2221.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2221A requires a license from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to operate a medical discount plan organization, requires medical plan organizations to have written contracts with the medical plan providers, requires licensees to offer a 30-day grace period, refund procedures, a toll-free line, and a website, and disclose that the plan is not insurance but a discount plan. Licensees must refrain from deceptive marketing, authorizes DCBS rulemaking and investigation, authorizes statutory damages of $100 for each discount medical plan membership sold, or $10,000, whichever greater, and treble actual damages, allows injunctive relief, declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And for House Bill 2221, Carl Lundberg. And is there anyone else who wanted to be given testimony besides Mr. Lundberg today on this one?
Thank you, Chair Prosansky, members of the committee. My name's Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to request the committee's support for House Bill 2221A, which proposes a regulatory program for medical discount plans. Medical discount plans are not insurance and currently are unregulated in Oregon, except for those offering prescription drug discounts. Although many plans are legitimate operations, not all of them are. You may have seen advertisements such as the two that are attached to the back of my written testimony. Show up on your fax machine or other places. If you look at these advertisements, you see they say affordable health care, doctor visits, hospital, dental, vision, pre-existing conditions accepted, and the rates are low, $100 or less per month. That really may sound like a great deal for health insurance, but these products are not health insurance. If you sign up for one, you're still fully responsible for all of your health care costs. House Bill 2221 requires disclosure that the plan members are responsible for their health costs because, unlike true insurance, no risks are transferred to the company selling the card. Instead, the company selling the card has simply negotiated a set of medical providers, the discounts with medical providers, and those providers have agreed to give the discounts to the people holding the card. In some cases, this may have a real value, and the card may represent a real sensible choice. For example, if your prescription drug costs are high and you don't have insurance to cover the drugs, your prescription drug discount card may give you savings that well exceed the cost of the card. In other cases, though, the sales pitch is deceptive, and the cards provide little or no value. The provider network may be restricted, or it may not include providers in or near the buyer's hometown. For example, a rural customer might find that their discounts only apply to a handful of doctors in the Portland area. In the worst case, the provider list may be fraudulent and contain names of providers who have no connection to the plan and will not offer the promised discount. Even when the discounts are real, they may not cover major medical expenses, which are the ones precisely that the consumers really want to cover. That's why HB 2221A prohibits operation of a medical discount plan without a written contract with service providers or a network of service providers. The sales tactics used by these vendors of these cards are also a concern. Advertising is often misleading. High-pressure tactics are used. The cards often require requirements for upfront membership costs, which could be as much as $100 or even $500. And many times the consumers are required to authorize automatic withdrawal from their bank accounts. If the consumer then concludes that the plan doesn't have any value, either upon reviewing the plan materials or after trying to get a discount, it may prove very difficult to get a refund or to cancel the plan and even to get the monthly charges against their bank account stopped. In some cases, people have even had to cancel their bank accounts. That's why this bill provides a 30-day free look period with a right of cancellation and establishes refund requirements. The health costs of insurance are a concern to all of us, but medical discount cards often make a poor substitute. We don't propose to ban the sale of these cards because in appropriate cases they can be reasonable and valuable choices. We want your support for House Bill 2221A, which requires medical discount providers to be licensed to ensure that the Oregonians have access to legitimate medical discount cards and protection from those that are fraudulent. To help Oregonians know what they are buying, this bill establishes advertising restrictions and disclosure requirements so that the consumer will have information regarding the discounts offered and the providers who participate, as well as notice that the consumer is going to have to pay the bill. To protect Oregonians, the bill authorizes the director to investigate license applications and violations of law, to refuse to issue licenses, to suspend and revoke and refuse to renew licenses. It's my understanding that you've received a letter in support of this bill from Alan Ehrenbaum, counsel to the Consumer Health Alliance, the trade association of the discount healthcare industry. I respectfully request that you support House Bill 2221A engrossed, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Sure. Senator Beyer.
I don't know who this is from. I thought the whole committee probably got it, but apparently not. Apparently just myself and Senator Brown. But it's basically saying that the CHA is pushing this legislation because it will help them keep other competitors out of the marketplace.
Senator Prozanski, Vice Chair Beyer, there is no intent to keep anybody who can meet the qualifications out of the marketplace. All this does is make sure that people who are in the marketplace are making the proper disclosures so that consumers can evaluate what they're buying. In addition, this is a bill which has been patterned after a model that was created by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So it's been vetted around, and there are other states which are adopting this similar language. We believe that this will help consumers in Oregon and will not prohibit anybody from being able to enter this marketplace, provided they show us their advertising and they make the disclosures that are required, they offer free looks, and so forth.
Do you know if this legislation has been passed in Florida?
I do not know that.
Okay. Any other questions? We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2221. I'm going to open up a work session on 2221. And Chair is looking for a motion.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Not seeing any, so ordered. And the Chair will carry this one.
Okay.
Do my fair share. So we'll close the work session on 2221. We'll open up our last public hearing for today, which is House Bill 2223.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2223A expands the definition of employer to include successor employers for the purposes of occupational safety violations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and let's see, on 2223, I think it's Michael Wood.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. I'm here today to provide information and request the committee's support of House Bill 2223A. Again, I have written testimony, and I will not belabor that. This bill was introduced at our request to address an issue that we fear may be a growing issue, and it has to do with those employers who in some fashion reconfigure or change their identity for illegitimate purposes. In our case, it's a concern about the degree to which they may be doing it, either to escape financial obligations or legal obligations because of the way our penalty structure operates. Like every other safety and health jurisdiction in the country, we issue penalties in the case of serious violations. Unlike most other jurisdictions, however, our first instance penalties in those cases are relatively modest. In fact, Oregon consistently has the lowest average penalties for a first-time serious violation in the country. The idea behind that is that we then can ramp up if we have employers who persist in allowing the same violation or similar violations to go unchecked. So in the case of such repeat or failure to abate violations, the penalties can become significant. That, of course, depends on our ability to know that we are dealing with the same employer that we had previously cited. So in addition to the fact that an employer may reconfigure simply to avoid liability for penalties that have already been assessed, we do run into employers who appear to reconfigure so that they can start fresh with a clean slate and those modest first instance penalties. I know that other agencies have addressed successorship issues. In this session, there's a bill related to the Department of Revenue that has already moved out of the Senate. It's a similar issue for all of us. In the case of Oregon OSHA, we do have that unique issue related to how we handle repeat violations, but we will, as we look at how we will address it in the context of rulemaking, we'll look both at perhaps that Department of Revenue model and also at the existing Bureau of Labor and Industries rules, which get at some of the same issues. I have in my testimony some examples of the sort of concern that we're talking about. And unfortunately, I can't tell you how often this happens, precisely because there's no way for us to hold employers accountable, or at least little way for us to hold employers accountable. We don't put the files together that would allow us to count them. But when I talk to my staff, and basically talk to the staff in our appeals processing unit, if they can come up with some examples, I will tell you that they can always hand me an example that has crossed their desk in some fashion over the last 2 to 3 weeks. And those are examples are found on the third page of my testimony. I want to just highlight actually the most recent example that came to my attention, and it refers to a recent conversation that one of our enforcement officers had on site with an employer. And in that conversation, we were going over the violations that had been found and the penalties that would be assessed. The employer indicated that he was going to appeal, that he was going to instruct his attorney to aggressively seek to reduce the penalty, and that if it wasn't successful, if they weren't successful in reducing the penalty, he would simply change his business name and continue working. That's exactly the concern we have, is that when the perception exists out there that you don't have to pay the penalties, then the value of penalties as a motivator, or the value of risk of penalties as a motivator, is eliminated. And unfortunately, what happens is those employers who play by the rules and who pay their obligations end up at a competitive disadvantage with the employers who are not. That's the underlying concern that is intended by this bill. One thing I do want to state clearly is that as we move forward on this, our concern is with business entities that reconfigure. We collect penalties. It is a small revenue stream to the state, but we collect penalties because of the value of a penalty to motivate certain types of behavior. We don't see ourselves as a revenue producer, and in fact, in the large scheme of things, we don't produce all that much revenue. However, it is important that employers, that we be able to hold employers accountable in the form of the penalties that we've assessed, and that we be able to collect those monies when they are owed. In those cases, we think it's important that if a person is continuing to operate, you know, potentially with a very similar business name, so similar that the business cards and painting on the side of the truck doesn't have to change, with the same employees doing the same business, producing the same product, but they have renamed their corporation or reinstituted under a new corporation, we want to be able to declare that that is in fact the same employer for our purposes and apply the rules accordingly. With that, I thank you for your time, and I am open to respond to any questions.
Senator Beyer first.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Wood, did you have a chance to check on worker comp language or employment department language dealing with this issue? But there's two different issues. In workers comp and employment department, you get bonuses for having a good rating, and we have some point in time in the past 2 or 4 sessions have said, for purpose of experience rating, you can, if you change your business practice, you can use your old business rating in order to give employers a benefit on their premiums. But also, just last session, I believe, we did for the employment department, I think it was called pseudo dumping, where people were changing their names to avoid paying employment tax. And so did you get a chance to look and see if this language is the same as what that we did in those areas?
Chair Prusansky, Vice Chair Beyer, the concept is similar. The language is actually somewhat different, and it has to do with the fact that there are some underlying issues that vary slightly between the various regulatory agencies. I also, as you suggested, actually had some lengthy conversations about the underwriting practices related to workers' compensation. I did have the opportunity to speak with the underwriting manager at SAFE, not only about the fact that, of course, an employer wants to keep their good experience, but it's in the interest of the insurance provider to make sure that the employer also keeps their negative experience. Mr. Schultz is in the room and can probably address this in more accurate detail than I can, but based on that conversation, it's clear to me that under the NCCI guidelines that SAFE and the other workers' compensation carriers in the state follow, they actually have what I would describe as a much more liberal ability to go after employers and make sure that they're applying experience even as they reconfigure. They talk about, you know, if there is a commonality of ownership above 51%, that actually allows them to look at carrying things over. As I think about the rules that we'd be adopting, we'd actually be much more conservative than that. And so in that sense, I think the model that works for them for the purposes of experience rating doesn't necessarily serve as well for a regulatory agency that's looking at making sure that a business entity or employer is held accountable.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We also talked about effective date, and so if there is a sole proprietor out there today that has a OSHA complaint or OSHA violation against them, and this bill is to pass, and then they change after that to a LLC or a corporation, same owner, this bill would apply in that instance. Is that correct?
Chair Prusansky, Vice Chair Beyer, yes, it is correct in my understanding that when it comes to the definition, that they would still be an employer for under the purposes of the Act once the statute has been passed. That's probably most significant in relation to the experience. We wouldn't want those employers who are out there now to all collectively get a clean slate. And if we were to inspect that employer again in a year and could build the case that, in fact, they were the same employer, we'd want to be able to do that even though it was based on the previous experience.
What about the case where the employer has already changed business entities prior to this passing? See, they were 5 years ago, they were an LLC, or it doesn't matter, LLC. They then changed, say, 2 years ago to a corporation. LLC had some violations against them. Corporation may or may not have, but you go inspect them, but the change has already happened. Prior to passing this legislation, would this retroactively allow you to go back and look backward in that case?
Chair Prusansky, Vice Chair Beyer, I would not describe it as retroactively. We would be able, in looking at an employer at this time, to look essentially at their history using the definitions in the bill. I do not see anything in the bill that limits us to a particular date at which the event occurred. Now, of course, it wouldn't be an issue if we didn't find any violations this time, because there wouldn't be a question of repeat. The other thing I should mention, that when it comes to the general principles of applying repeat violations, there actually is a 3-year window. So we do not cite employers on repeat violations if the underlying violation is more than 3 years old.
All right, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, we had a bill in revenue that dealt with businesses that withhold the taxes for their employees and then don't pay the department. And when the department catches up on them, they do this. They change their identity in some way to avoid paying what they owe. It seems like we passed a bill, I think, that came out of the Senate Revenue Committee this year that would deal with that. Do you remember any such bill?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Monroe, if I'm correct, that was Senate Bill 176, which did pass out of that committee as well as out of the full Senate.
Sounds right. I think I carried it. Okay.
That's my understanding.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or discussion?
Sure.
Michael, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2223? I close the public hearing on 2223. Going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2223.
Mr. Chair, the issue of how far back they can go with this language is a concern to me as to whether or not, if entities have already changed prior to the passing of this. I understand if they change after this, that seems logical. But if entities have already happened, it seems that it does make a bill retroactive. And I was wondering if there are any issues. I don't know what you'd call it, equal protection or due process questions about that in the context of this bill.
I don't know.
It's a fair question.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer to it either. There certainly are, I think, some constitutional preclusions on retroactive lawmaking, but I don't...
Ex post facto.
Yeah, I don't know how it applies to this.
Yeah, since it's not criminal. I mean, we can look...
We call Charlie Cheek back down here for a minute.
Well, why don't we do this? I'm going to ask Ms. Braun to follow up on that. I'm going to go ahead and close the, I think, the work session at this time, unless someone else has any other comments. I'll close the work session on 2223, understanding that we'll have Ms. Braun check in with counsel regarding the questions that Senator Beyer brought up. I don't think there's an issue there on that basis, but let's go ahead and check it out. I mean, so I think it's a policy issue at worst. Or at best, I guess, as to whether we want to have it go back in time. And the question, you know, for me would be probably the length of time that one would reach back as compared to whether they should or shouldn't, because clearly, I don't know if we should, let's say, allow everyone that's had one or two bites at the apple and getting out of this, that they don't have to live with their records from those previous entities going forward. Any other comments?
Well, I guess on that, Mr. Chair, I would say that passing of the bill would limit the bites of the apple if you made it apply to only entity changes from the passage forward, and then recognize this bill doesn't have an emergency clause, so it wouldn't go into effect until January. You may, right. if you want to make that policy change, you may want to make an earlier starting date on that so people wouldn't have a 6 or 7 month window to make these changes quick so they wouldn't be caught. But otherwise, it seems like they, you know, if someone's sitting there and has an OSHA violation and then they change after that, they don't get another bite of the apple once this bill passes. So I don't think it is a 2 or 3 bites of the apple question if you were to put a policy, you know, a starting date or, you know, only changes of entities after a certain date.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look at that, and we'll have Ms. Braun check in with counsel, and also Michael Wood, as to some of the suggestions you just made. If there's nothing else, then we're going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2223. And, Anna, is there anything else we need to go over? For next week?
For Wednesday.
I think the only other thing we had for the committee is on Wednesday we got a pretty heavy schedule. A lot of bills that are coming back for work session. And Ms. Braun and I had talked earlier about this, and I think what I wanted to do was go ahead and move those out. If you have any issues regarding any of those bills.
He's referring to the Boley bills.
The Boley bills that we had, that first set of House bills. Please get your comments to Anna by tomorrow so we can have our schedule, because I want to try to knock those out.
Consent calendar?
As quickly as we can, so we won't be here the full time.
And the committee should know that we have canceled our meetings on the 14th and the 6th.
Right. Next week, because of other obligations, we'll be standing down no committee for Monday or Wednesday. So that's one reason I want to try to get everything that we've got on our schedule for this coming Wednesday taken care of, and then I'll be back at it the week from that following Monday. All right.
Hoping we won't need night meetings.
Well, hopefully. Yeah. All right. We'll adjourn.
Wash your mouth out.